I next met with Dr. Chuck Drake, and given the rapid proliferation of clinical trial data and drug approvals with checkpoint inhibitors, it seemed like a good time to take a step back and reconsider the basic biologic and pharmacologic issues with immunotherapy and checkpoint inhibitors, and Dr. Drake tackled this tall order.
So just starting at the beginning, where immune checkpoint therapies fit in terms of cancer therapy, we think that these therapies start out when tumor already has some anti-tumor T cells in it, particularly CD8 killer T cells. The tumors that we see in the clinic are ones that are actually growing, so that means that the CD8 T cells are there, but they're not doing their job. Recently, as in the last 10 years or 5 years, it was shown that one of the main reasons they're not working is they have on their surface a series of molecules that we call checkpoints that are stopping them from working. When the checkpoints bind to their ligands, or for example, when PD-1 binds to PD-L1, then the T cell is effectively turned off. It can't proliferate and it can't kill. What's fascinating is they're not a single checkpoint. There are a series of checkpoints, but it looks like PD-1 is maybe one of the most important. And that's because when you block PD-1 and allow PD-1 signaling not to turn off the T cell, then the T cells proliferate, and then they can also kill tumor cells. You can see this because in patients, when you block PD-1 in patients with kidney cancer, bladder cancer, melanoma, or lung cancer, a fair percentage have actual shrinkage of their tumors. And that's evidence that the CD8 T cells are actually probably killing tumor cells in the patients. So that's the one checkpoint, PD-1, and again, it acts on CD8 T cells. But there are several more, actually. CTLA-4 was actually the first checkpoint to be worked on in the clinic, and CTLA-4 is probably more on CD4 T cells, probably more on cells that are in the tumor that are regulatory cells and turning off the CD8 cells. So when you use an antibody to CTLA-4, you affect a different portion of cells, right? So the PD-1 is probably on the CD8 cells. The CTLA-4 is probably more on the CD4 cells. And when you do that, it's interesting, in animal models and sort of in patients as well, what you see is not an additive effect, but more of a synergistic effect. In animals, it's actually dramatic. There are some cases where PD-1 does nothing, CTLA-4 blockade does nothing, and when you do both, you can see complete regressions and cures.
So, and I know at this point, there's a lot of interest in combining those strategies, and the anti-CTLA-4 agent we're most used to hearing about is ipilimumab, particularly from melanoma. What do we know right now about the combination across all tumor types?
It's always better. So that's a great question. So it's always better than either of the drugs alone. In some tumor types, particularly melanoma, it looks like it's a lot better, bordering on synergistic, actually. In kidney cancer, it's better, actually. The phase 2 data that my colleague, Dr. Hammers, presented previously really show that the response rate goes from about 25% to about 40 or 45%. So that's a lot more than PD-1 alone, but it's not really the synergistic effect that you see in melanoma. Nevertheless, the combination has never been worse than either drug alone. The price you pay, of course, is increased toxicity. So whereas PD-1 is really quite well tolerated, PD-1 blockade has an adverse event rate of grade 3-4 adverse events, probably in the 15% range. CTLA-4 a little higher, maybe 20 to 25. When you give them together, then you see a higher incidence of autoimmune events like colitis, sometimes pneumonitis and dermatitis. When we first started doing this was a big problem, right? Patients would have a sudden onset of adverse events. But now that we and other folks who do this are more used to it, the prompt initiation of immunosuppressive therapies, particularly steroids at first, then moving on if that's not work, really hasn't made it so most of these events don't progress to that grade 3-4 anymore. So we're able to catch them and treat them a little bit earlier, making these regimens that are actually practical that can be done in the clinic.
When you sort of take a step back and sort of think about this whole exploding arena, what are some of the key questions from both the basic science as well as clinical perspective that you think right now are on the forefront of the field?
Yeah, I think that there's a series of questions that we could talk about. I think one of the main questions that we're facing with anti-PD-1, anti-PD-L1 is quite simple, exactly how long to treat. So when we first started these trials, they treated for a fixed period, sometimes a year, sometimes 2 years, and then would stop. Now some of the trials that are ongoing treat continuously forever. If patients have an ongoing response and they're tolerating the drug well, that sort of makes sense. But some of these patients are living a very long time. We're in the process of preparing a manuscript on some extreme responding patients who have lived between 4 and actually 8 years on these drugs. So if you're on continuous drug for 4 to 8 years, that might be a little bit long. So the question is how long to treat and what's the best regimen? Really, honestly, there's two critical clinical questions there. So first of all, if a patient has a stable ongoing response, which many do with these drugs, and you stop, how many patients will maintain that response off treatment? We know it's not zero, actually. In the paper that Dave McDermott and I published in JCO this year, we showed that there are a fair number of patients, even on the phase 1B trial, who had long-term responses off treatment. So we know it's not a zero, but we know that from following some of these patients, some of them eventually will relapse.
Could I just interject, too? You know, you had presented a case, actually, at the GU symposium of a patient. I think it was the first patient ever treated with nivolumab for renal cell who got three doses of the drug 8 years ago, eventually got into a complete remission, and now is still in complete remission. How do you visualize the pathophysiology, what's going on with this patient as opposed to every other one?
Great question, actually. So there's two or three things that we can imagine. One thing is that he was lucky enough to make anti-tumor T cells that were both very specific for his tumor and very effective. Also, that his tumor metastases that might have been evolving might be a little bit more related to each other and that they might all carry that mutation. So I think that that's one thing that he might have that other patients haven't had. To be honest, we did sequence his tumor, and I could tell you that one thing that was interesting is he didn't have a ton of mutations. It wasn't like he had two or three times as many mutations. So it must have been that he had the lucky mutations that he had a nice response to. And I got to tell you, I mean, honestly, people ask me this all the time, do you really think that this patient is cured? And I always say, well, I certainly hope so. But it is possible that what happens is he might have a few tumor cells in his body that his immune system keeps fighting continuously, actually. So we don't really know that, actually. We can't see any tumor. We actually scanned him with a complete CT scan. We also did an MRI of the brain to make sure that he had no CNS disease, and he was completely, by those scans, tumor-free. And why is this patient like this and other patients are not? We really don't know right now. We've studied him intensively, though.
What actually is your vision in terms of, I mean, from a more basic point of view, you know, really why people get cancer and, you know, how it's related to the immune system? You know, I've heard of the concept of the fact that, well, maybe, you know, if you sort of decrease the tumor bulk, the immune system can sort of rev itself back up in very intuitive, non-biologic terms. But do you have any sort of biologic explanations?
Yeah, it's a good question, actually. So tumors in humans arise in the context of an immune system, right? So the patients that we see, their immune system is preventing infections. And usually there's good evidence that the immune system at least tries to recognize the tumor. Many tumors are infiltrated with T cells, again, suggesting that those mutations are recognized. But what happens, honestly, is that the tumor eventually escapes from the immune pressure. So the way we visualize it is that there's some pressure initially from the immune system on the tumor, but the tumor develops ways around that. How strongly it escapes might be related to how well these drugs work. For example, that tumors that have escaped by one or two mutations or by one mechanism might be more susceptible to treatment. And to be honest with you, we know actually by our clinical experience that some of the tumors, the way they escaped, was the tumor upregulated PD-L1 and the T cells had PD-1 on them. And we know that that must be at least one of the primary mechanisms because when we block it, it works, right?
Could it be that really the issue is the host, though, the immune system itself, maybe some variation of it?
Yeah, it's quite a good point, actually. So your immune system is generated at an early age and ongoing through a series of random events. So even identical twins have different immune systems. The kinds of antigens they can recognize, their T cell repertoire, the kinds of T cells they have, are a little bit different. So everyone's different in terms of their ability to recognize antigens, including tumor antigens.
So another basic issue I was curious about, and I see you have a bunch of papers of looking at this question. A lot of people mention it. I don't know exactly if I have much of an intuitive feel for it, which is the issue of radiation therapy and checkpoint inhibition, you know, the abscopal effect and all that stuff. I see you've written a bunch of papers on it. You want to talk about your thinking about it?
Absolutely. So, you know, one idea when you think about combined immunotherapy is in many tumors, as you know, the immune system is insufficient to mediate tumor shrinkage or getting rid of a tumor. So what things can you add to immune checkpoint blockade or immunotherapy to have a better outcome, a better response rate? So conventional things, chemotherapy people think of, hormonal therapy, we just talked about combining two checkpoints to blockade them. But it's interesting, actually, out of all those things and all the things that we conventionally use, one really interesting thing is radiation therapy. Radiation therapy kills cells. It's good. I mean, we know that it can, you know, cure primary tumors in many patients. But it's interesting, when radiation kills cells, it kills them in a way that's immunogenic, that activates the immune system. So the idea is maybe radiation therapy can be used as a sort of a vaccine to sort of start an anti-tumor response, which then can be propagated by blocking a checkpoint like anti-PD-1 with anti-PD-1.
Is there any thinking that the immune system is part of the radiation therapy effect?
Very good question. You know, there are some models of radiation therapy. So the experiment that can be done in animals, right? So you give a mouse a tumor and then you radiate it and you cure the mouse. You do the same experiment in a mouse without much of an immune system that's immunocompromised, and you don't cure the mouse, actually. So there's some suggestion that even in normal radiation therapy, in standard radiation therapy, there's in fact an immunological effect.
You had a paper specifically this year looking at stereotactic radiation therapy. Is there anything different about that?
Yeah, the one thing that paper shows that's interesting is when you kill a tumor with radiation, what happens to the tumor proteins, the tumor antigens? How do they activate the immune system? There's two basic ways. One is at the tumor site itself, but the other is in the draining lymph node. That's the node that drains the tumor, and that's where a lot of immunological activity happens. This paper, I think, was interesting, and we think it was at least a little important, because what we showed in that model was that radiation allows tumor proteins to be presented in the lymph node, not in the tumor. You know, clinically, that raises a very interesting question, right? When you radiate a tumor, in some regimens, you radiate both the tumor and the lymph node. Sometimes you radiate just the tumor. Our studies suggest, but really don't answer the question, that maybe the outcome would be different if you radiate both the tumor and the lymph node versus the tumor, because sometimes the lymph node might be the place where the immune system is kicking in, where the immune reaction is starting. We have some experiments in place actually right as we speak to look at that issue. But I can tell you that even the preliminary data, man, radiating the tumor versus the tumor plus the lymph node is immunologically different.
Was there any difference, though, in the stereotactic radiation therapy as opposed to other types of radiation therapy?
Stereotactic radiation therapy actually probably is a better companion for the immune system in these results. And there's a couple reasons. One reason is it's more directed to the tumor area. And the second thing is that it happens fairly quickly. There's some good data from several groups, Ralph Reschelbaum at University in the University of Chicago, really showing that it's better to do stereotactic than fractionated radiation.
So another sort of general question I was curious about, and I see that you've had a number of papers in renal cell cancer, and I don't know, maybe this kind of research has been done with other tumors, certainly would think so, but one in particular I was curious, it was just presented at the GU Symposium, clinical pathologic and genomic profiles of exceptional responders to anti-PD-1 therapy. And I see you had another paper looking at transcriptional signatures associated with lack of response. What are you learning from this type of work?
Great question. So this is one of my favorite research projects, and it's really in collaboration with the urologist at Johns Hopkins, Mark Ball, a young resident who's been doing a fantastic job on this. So this is a series of patients who have been treated with PD-1 blocking agents over the years at Hopkins. We were able to identify four patients who did remarkably well, lived over 4 years after treatment. We were able to also obtain corresponding samples from a series of about three closely matched patients who were treated and had absolutely no response. And so the idea of the paper was, does anything jump out at you? Is there anything that really predicts these patients do remarkably well, actually? So we looked at the mutation frequency, and it was a little bit more, maybe about twice as much, but not like a night and day difference. We looked at prior treatments, nothing. We sequenced the tumors, actually, really carefully looking for particular mutations, found nothing. What we were able to do is do some profiling studies where we did a high-throughput analysis of immune genes in the tumors. And that actually was a little bit interesting. It's not a lot of patients, but the genes that looked to be different between the responders, extreme responders, and the non-responders didn't look like they were T-cell genes, Neil. They looked more like they were genes related to myeloid cells, like macrophages. This is really kind of important because when you think about combination therapies, it suggests, obviously, but doesn't prove, that may be thinking about combining checkpoints with some macrophage or myeloid-targeted drugs. And there are these drugs that do that. They're in phase 1 and phase 2. For example, CSF1R antibodies or inhibitors would be suggested by this work.
Now, are these germline or tumor mutations?
So these are actually not mutations per se. They're looking at the groups of cells that are in the tumors. So the patients that had a nice myeloid response, they're the ones that didn't respond as well to the anti-PD-1. So it looks like maybe that might be something, some kind of cells that are holding back the immune response.
And at a more sort of conventional level in terms of what we're hearing about, obviously, is the issue of PD-L1 staining. And again, this seems like it's being looked at in every single cancer. Is there sort of a global theme?
I think what's emerging is that sometimes, but not always, PD-L1 expression is a weak predictor of patients who might do better. At the GU ASCO meeting we were just at together, it was interesting what was shown in bladder cancer, for example, that there was a weak correlation between PD-L1 staining and response. But the remarkable thing, Neil, is if you look at the phase 2 bladder data with the antibody atezolizumab, even in the patients who had absolutely no PD-1 staining, zero, the response rate was 10%. In that setting, that's really around what you see with chemotherapy. And the part that struck me was about 100 patients with no PD-L1 staining at all. Out of those, Neil, two of them had a complete response. Complete response.
Wow. So, you know, in this whole discussion of, you know, what is it that's tied into the responses that are seen also is, you know, tied into what you see in different tumors. And I think that last meeting we were at together, we showed a slide I've shown a bunch of times, which is which of the following tumors is most sensitive to anti-PD-L1, PD-1 antibodies. And like, I think 6% of people got the right answer, which is Hodgkin lymphoma. And, you know, I guess I'd say, well, what does Hodgkin lymphoma, lung cancer, and head and neck cancer all have in common? And you hear things about mutational load. Is there any way you can put this whole puzzle together?
So what I would say they do all have in common, and you can put it together, is they all elicit a T-cell response, a CD8 T-cell response. This is very clear for Hodgkin's lymphoma, lung cancer, bladder cancer, and kidney cancer, and melanoma. So this is the one thing they have in common.
Do other tumors not elicit a T-cell response?
It's interesting, actually. Even within the field of kidney cancer, not all tumors are infiltrated, actually. Some tumors do and some tumors don't, actually.
What about breast and prostate? Because those kind of stick, even colon outside of MSI high, they sort of stick out as not being very responsive. What kind of T-cell infiltrates do you see there?
You know, we've actually just completed some studies, some RNA-based profiling studies in prostate cancer, and they are less infiltrated than other tumor types. The T-cells in prostate cancer do look like they have this exhausted phenotype like in other tumors. Neil, we've done staining on them. I got to tell you, they express PD-1. Okay, so they have PD-1. Interestingly, though, prostate cancer almost never has PD-L1, suggesting that it's not really inflamed enough for that access to be playing a role. Prostate is like one of the banes of my existence, frankly. We have a little bit of response to CTLA-4, a PSA response rate of around 15% or so. It's not nothing. PD-1 has been tested in the phase 1b trial, 17 patients, nobody with an objective response. Okay. What we're doing now and what's being done are two interesting things. At MD Anderson and UCSF, they're combining the prostate cancer vaccine, Sipuleucel-T. So the idea is use Sipuleucel-T to activate an anti-prostate CD8, hopefully CD8 response, and then to sort of boost it with anti-CTLA-4, actually. So it has a cute name. It's the Sipi-Ipi trial. So I think that's a pretty important trial, and that's pretty interesting. At Hopkins, we've been able to get through an IST, through myself and Dr. Antonarakis, Emmanuel, a trial where we'll treat patients with both ipilimumab and nivolumab, the Ipi-Nivo trial. We were unable to get this for patients at large, and you're familiar with these data that Emmanuel has generated showing that patients with a mutation in the AR called ARV7 do poorly. So the trial is to take those patients who don't have good treatment options and then to give them both anti-CTLA-4 ipilimumab and anti-PD-1 in the combination that was used in kidney cancer.
But what about CIP-T?
Yeah, we're going to start out with the Ipi-Nivo, actually, and we'll see what it's a great question. So it's a little bit of synergy, like on the clinical trial level. So we're going to let our colleagues and our friends, Pam Sharma at MD Anderson and Larry Fong at San Francisco, do the experiment with the Ipi. We're going to do the Ipi-Nivo experiment, and I think we'll get together at the end and decide what's a good next step going forward.
I'm curious about your thoughts. Do you think that CIP-T or really any other vaccine, you know, is effective immunologically?
Yeah, absolutely. We published a paper, and actually Larry Fong, I think Larry Fong's data are perhaps the most suggestive. Larry Fong took patients who were going to get a prostatectomy and showed that if they got Sipuleucel-T before their surgery, they had more T cells and more activated T cells in the gland. So I think that's pretty good data. The paper that we published actually showed that patients who get vaccinated with CIP-T develop a series of new antibodies, not only against the target antigen, which as you know is prostatic acid phosphatase, but also against a series of prostate-related proteins, and that the patients who make a wider spectrum of antibodies, antigen spread, tend to do better. So I do think for sure that CIP-T induces an immune response that can be measured, at least in some patients.
Maybe you can bring in the issue of T-cell stimulation and talk a little bit about your vision about how CAR T therapy works, how TIL therapy works, and whether you see a synergy there with checkpoint inhibitors.
Yeah, it's a great point, actually. So chimeric antigen receptor T-cells are really a fascinating idea. So what these T cells are engineered to have is they have a new T cell receptor. So the T cell receptor has a part that's out of the cell, an extracellular part, and a signaling part that leads to the killing function that's inside the cell. What CAR T cells are is that extracellular part, which is kind of weak. It's got a weak affinity. It's reasonably specific, but it's weak, has been replaced with an antibody. Antibodies are very high avidity. They're very potent. They're very specific. So the ones that you've read most about use an anti-CD19 antibody and then the internal machinery of a T cell receptor. So basically, you kind of like rebuild or rearm T cells. These T cells are beautiful. I mean, they can traffic according to that CD19 receptor. They can kill tumor cells quite brilliantly. The challenge that we face in solid tumors, though, is these T cells are a little bit maybe on the too good side. So the idea is that if there's even a little bit, somewhere around 10 molecules, right, of that target on another cell, then the T cells are potent enough to lyse it. So toxicity, off-label toxicity, has been seen in some of the solid tumor versions of CAR T cells. It remains to be seen whether we can either find a specific enough target or build CAR T cells with a suicide gene that you can kind of turn them off if they get out of hand and start mediating autoimmunity. So I think CAR T cells in hematologic malignancies work fine, but I think in solid tumors, it's a little bit of a next step thing going forward.
How about TIL therapy?
TIL is another interesting idea. So the idea is if a T cell is good, right, if a T cell is tumor specific and good, it ought to be in the tumor. So the way that these therapies work is you take out the tumor and you extract the T cells from within it. Again, the idea is that these must be good anti-tumor cells. You then expand them over time, and then you put them back into patients. The tricks are what I just said. Not all patients can undergo the resection to get the TILs taken out. The TIL preparation doesn't always succeed. It's actually very challenging. It's very well done at the NIH, but having that done at other places is maybe a little bit less simple. And a lot of people forget this, Neil. So when you do TIL therapy, the number of T cells that you can put in is a very small fraction of all the T cells in your body. And if you just took those T cells and put them in, they would get lost. They get lost in the crowd. So what happens to these patients in order to make room for the new T cells, the TIL T cells, they need to undergo an ablative regimen. They need to get radiation and chemotherapy usually. It's usually chemo rays, a regimen so that you can make rooms. And that's a little bit of a challenge for a sick cancer patient. That's where a little bit of the toxicity of the regimen comes in. Nevertheless, if it works, if you can make TIL, right, and you can prepare the patient beautifully by, again, by making space, the T cells that you come in, they expand and they fill the patient up, actually. And you wind up with these, it's actually really incredible, these really high percentages of anti-tumor T cells. So it's really a great idea, and it works quite beautifully in melanoma. And it's been shown to work really nicely in kidney cancer as well. Once again, making this something that's a little bit more universal is a bit of a challenge.
What about high-dose interleukin-2 and as well as interferon?
You know, honestly, so high-dose interleukin-2 is a blunt instrument, okay? It's a very blunt instrument. So the way we identify the bad cells, the regulatory T cells, is by expression of a molecule called CD25. CD25 is the receptor for interleukin-2. So when you give interleukin-2, you both activate effector cells, but you also affect the existing regulatory T cells. And interestingly, in the world of autoimmunity, lower doses of IL-2 are being used to expand or increase the function of regulatory T cells and turn off the response. This a little bit explains why IL-2 doesn't work in every patient, right? When it works brilliantly, but because of its pleiotropic body-wide effects, it leads to hypotension, shock, even death. So it's really probably not being used as much as it used to be.
So one other general question. Seems like there's a fair amount of research combining things like chemotherapy, targeted therapy with checkpoint inhibitors. And to me, it kind of seems a little counterintuitive, particularly to combine chemo. What's the thinking there?
We've published a couple of papers on this and actually done a fair number of experiments that we didn't publish. We studied this mostly in a mouse model of prostate cancer. We tried to combine a vaccine with chemotherapy. What we found was interesting. So cyclophosphamide, for example, is an immunogenic chemotherapy. And we could get this to combine really beautifully with the vaccine. But the trick was it had to be given at a precise time, one day before the immunotherapy, and at a precise dose, which was much lower than the clinical dose, about a third of the clinical dose. So the challenge is a lot of the regimens that you see going into the clinic don't take those sorts of things into account. They just use full-dose chemo plus some checkpoint. And I got to tell you, from the animal studies we did, it didn't seem like those kinds of regimens ever led you know, to an additive or certainly not to a synergistic effect. Some chemos are particularly tough, right? So docetaxel in our hands, we never publish this because we never find a dose or schedule that combine nicely with immunotherapy in our hands. So chemotherapies are all different, but my personal sense is that using full-dose chemotherapy with immunotherapy really kind of maybe neglect some of the essential factors of immunotherapy.
So let's talk a little bit about the three cancers that we're focused on with this program, particularly with an eye towards where immunotherapy is fitting in, starting out with renal cell. And just by way of background, before we get into some of the new data, maybe you can just talk a little bit again about your vision of the biology of the disease and why it is that we have this long history of immune phenomena and immune therapy with renal cell.
It's fascinating. Renal cell tumors are frequently infiltrated with immune cells, particularly T cells. We've been doing experiments in the lab trying to gather those T cells. We've done it actually with all the three cancers, bladder, kidney, and prostate. And kidney is easy. I mean, it's really easy. There's lots of T cells in the tumor. It's easy to find them. It's easy to get them out. And if you look at the really old literature, Neil, there have been reports of spontaneous remissions of kidney cancer. Actually, it's rare. It's anecdotal. It's obviously something only for case report. But there is a sense that the immune system is already recognizing kidney tumors, actually. So that's maybe why PD-1 has been reasonably effective.
One of the themes I think you see a little bit is the issue of smoking-related cancers. You know, you have lung cancer, you have head and neck cancer. And, you know, smoking has been associated with renal cell. Is that an important connection in terms of immunity and renal cell?
You know, what you said is perceptive, actually. So in lung cancer, it's very clear data have been presented that cancers that arise, lung cancers arise in smokers have more mutations. More mutation gives more fodder for the immune system to recognize. And so those tumors tend to respond better. Bladder tumors are reasonably well mutated as well. So the higher mutation rate in bladder cancer might be one of the things that helps to explain why the immune system recognizes them so well. Kidney cancer, that hasn't been worked out yet. And I got to tell you, if you look at the mutation rate of kidney cancers in the TCGA and the big data set that's been assembled, it's not so high. It's in the range of 50. This is something that puzzles me all the time, and I'll just share my puzzlement with you. So melanoma, 300, 500 mutations, response rate 30, 35%, pretty good. Kidney cancer, mutation rate about 50. Response rate, still pretty good, 25%. So obviously there's something beyond the mutations.
What other things might be involved? And, you know, we were talking before about Hodgkin lymphoma, and, you know, there's maybe a viral connection. What other mechanisms might be involved with renal cell?
So the other mechanisms that we think of renal cell and sometimes in bladder as well are some epigenetic mechanisms. So these are changes in the DNA expression that are not encoded within the DNA. They can affect the expression of many, many genes. And it could be that the epigenetic changes in kidney cancer are some things that affect the way the immune system recognizes it.
That's interesting. You know, it seems like Hopkins has been the center of the interest in epigenetic issues, although it's kind of hard for me to figure out where it's led. Do you see these two things coming together?
I got to tell you, this is one of the things I'm most excited about, actually. So my friend and colleague, Roberto Pili, presented finally at GeoASCO some data from a trial that he had started when he was at Hopkins a while ago, where patients with kidney cancer were given atinostat, an epigenetic drug, along with immunotherapy, in this case was IL-2. He set a really high bar. He wanted to see a double response rate or a 50% increase in the response rate to IL-2 from about 25, which was already fairly generous, to around 40 or so. They almost made it, actually. So it was really pretty obvious, actually, from his data that treatment with atinostat was increasing the response rate to IL-2.
So let's drill down into sort of where we are today with immunotherapy, starting out with renal cell. Can you sort of provide a sort of broad perspective on what we know right now from clinical research in terms of checkpoint inhibitors specifically in renal cell?
Yeah, actually, so what we know now is very clearly from the phase 3 data that there's a response rate of about 25% and a clear survival advantage in the second line. So anti-PD-1 is almost certainly going to be the default second-line treatment for many, many patients. We also know from data from Hans Hammers and others that the combination of anti-CTLA-4 and anti-PD-1, ipilimumab and nivolumab, looks like it's at least additive in kidney cancer. That regimen was taken into the first-line setting. That trial is accrued, so I think within a year or so, we'll know whether immunotherapy really should be in the first line, probably in that combination.
So there's no single agent PD-1 or PD-L1 arm there, just the combination?
Yeah, it's the combination of anti-PD-1 plus anti-CTLA-4 versus a tyrosine kinase inhibitor.
Fascinating. I was going to ask you before, actually, about anti-angiogenics, tyrosine kinase inhibitors, as well as monoclonal antibodies like bevacizumab and the immune system. I've heard people say that somehow part of their mechanism is immune related. Is that true? And again, do you see the viability of combining them?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, people forget these older data on these drugs in mice. The mouse version is called DC-101. It's been studied fairly extensively. And what you can see, actually, when you use these drugs is that this is something that's not always well appreciated. Tumors have leaky blood vessels, right? And you would think that leaky blood vessels are good. Then immune cells could really migrate out of those leaky blood vessels into the tumor. Turns out that's not true. Those leaky tumor blood vessels are really present a barrier to T-cell immigration. When you give anti-VEGF or the mouse version of anti-VEGF to mice, what happens is you normalize the vasculature. Now the vasculature behaves normally and T cells can emigrate out. So there's actually a very good biological rationale for the combination of VEGF blocking agents and immunotherapy. The other thing too, actually, Neil, is that VEGF, if you look at it just by itself, just VEGF, what it does actually is turns off antigen-presenting cells. It turns off dendritic cells. So blocking VEGF could have a double whammy. Actually, it could help the dendritic cells to work better and help the T cells get better into the tumor.
So getting back to the clinical research, you mentioned the second line work that's been done. And I also was curious what you think about the trial designs that are being used right now. In a way, it sort of seems a little strange. You know, you see this in lung cancer too, the second line against docetaxel. You know, a big phase 3 study, you know, typical kind of phase 3 endpoint. But yet, it seems like what we're really interested in are these long responses. You kind of wonder about why their trials are designed this way. What I really want to know, I think what clinicians want to know is, what's the chance that the patient's going to get launched into a prolonged response?
Yeah, I actually could not possibly agree more, right? So patients don't really care as much about changes in median survival or even response rate. They want to know what the rate of long-term responses are. The way to do that statistically is called like a landmark analysis, how many patients are alive at a certain time point. And this has been proposed as an endpoint for immunotherapy trials. But so far, really none of the phase threes that we've looked at have used a landmark analysis.
Have they gone back to look at that? I mean, for example, I think it would be very interesting in renal cell, I guess, to look at about a year.
Absolutely.
What would you estimate the chance of, you know, for example, somebody still having disease control with everolimus versus a PD-1 antibody at a year?
Yeah, so based on the phase 1b and the phase 3 data, I mean, it's actually quite good with anti-PD-1. It's probably in the range of 50%, maybe even a little bit higher, maybe more like 60%. Everolimus, those data are well established. It's probably a fair amount lower in the range of 25%, maybe even a little bit less, actually. So that's a great way to think about it, and that's the way we think about it when we talk to patients. So if you take this drug, your chances of being alive and without progression at a year are pretty good.
So even if you think about it from what we know, even though, yes, we don't really have any first-line data, but, I mean, even really going back and thinking about the melanoma paradigm in BRAF-positive disease, where unless the patient's really sick, they want to go with the immunotherapy again, trying to launch the patient into a prolonged response. You know, if you could, or I don't know, maybe you actually do it based on the data we have right now, would you give a PD-1, PD-L1 antibody up front with renal cell? I would, again, imagine that the chance of long-term response even up front should be greater, but maybe not.
It's a great question, actually, and this is something that we just don't have a lot of data on. The small amount of data we have are from the randomized dose-finding study that BMS conducted early in the development of nivolumab. Those data were a little bit less than totally impressive. The response rate in that cohort on the first line was less. It was more in the range of 13 or 15%. Still, you have to remember, Neil, those were small numbers of patients. And, you know, those were small numbers of patients from a fairly larger trial. So I actually have to tell you that I really don't know what the response rate is going to be in phase one. What you say is true. It could turn out that the response rate is actually higher early in the disease course. It could also turn out, though, honestly, that perhaps some of these other therapies condition the tumor in a way that PD-1 is likely to work better. I think we really won't know. And as we mentioned, the first-line trial in kidney cancer that's been completed, the phase 3 trial, is not PD-1 monotherapy. It's the combination therapy. So to be honest with you, if I took a patient who just came in with newly diagnosed kidney cancer and they said to me, what are the chances my tumor is going to shrink? What are the chances I'm going to be alive a year from now? I would have to be honest and tell them, look, we really don't know. From later stage disease, we have a pretty good idea. But from early stage disease, we don't know. Maybe as more patients are accrued in that earlier setting, we might find that out.
So at this point, then, you're thinking basically the approved agent, nivolumab, second line, and pretty much everybody?
I'm thinking so, actually. The one thing to keep in mind that should be appreciated is that, frankly, nivolumab is very, very well tolerated, right? So, you know, it's actually interesting. You could easily imagine patients who have problems with blood pressure, who are basically a little bit more frail, who have these kind of conditions. So you could imagine, as a matter of fact, I have a patient in my clinic for right now, actually, just this morning, who's an older gentleman, a little bit more frail, problems with hypertension, a couple other medical problems. I just don't feel that good about giving him a tyrosine kinase inhibitor. He's already having some fatigue, right? I mean, he's just not the person that I would like to see have a side effect on a TKI. So there clearly are clinically going to be patients where you as a clinician would say, you know, maybe I should really give this guy to PD-1 first.
What are you going to do with that patient?
We're still struggling, actually. He and his family and I have been talking about it. The one challenge is it's very unlikely that it'll get reimbursed in the first line.
Interesting. You know, another thing I was going to ask you about in general, and also it applies whenever these agents are being considered, is the issue of prior autoimmune disease. This is such a vexing clinical problem, particularly when you're really in a desperate situation with a patient. They really want to take a shot at this kind of treatment. And yet, it seems like none of these drugs have really been looked at in patients with autoimmune disease. Any sort of thoughts about, theoretically, I guess there's a little bit of data. I think I saw a paper in JAMA. Or JAMA Oncology, looking at this with IPI, what do we know about this, and how do you approach this question clinically?
Yeah, I mean, so what you say is true. The phase 3, and actually all the trials on these, eliminated patients or excluded patients with prior autoimmune disease. And the question that I would ask patients when they're coming on the trials, I would say, listen, have you ever had steroids for something autoimmune on a regular basis? So autoimmune disease enough that you had to have steroids, psoriasis, severe arthritis, things like that. So patients like that were excluded. Now, to be fair, patients with mild arthritis, non-steroid requiring, were on these trials. And if you look at the adverse events, some of those cases actually got worse arthritis. That's certainly better than having your cancer progress. So there's always, with anything, a risk versus benefit. Now, when patients have severe autoimmune disease, for example, psoriatic arthritis, which is really a systemic autoimmune disease, this is a challenge, actually. Especially a challenge in later stage disease when you know that they really don't have any good treatment options. This is about the only option that gives them a chance of long-term survival. I think what's going to happen is patients and physicians are going to have to approach this on a case-by-case basis, really looking at the risk versus benefit. You know, in the first line or early on where there's treatment options, maybe not. But later on, in the later stages of disease, when there's not as many treatment options, that, you know, considering the risk of having autoimmune disease, even fatal, it's still a risk, actually, whereas the risk of have the patient dying from cancer in those cases might be 100%. So you can say, look, you have 100% chance of dying of cancer within the next 6 to 12 months, whereas we have some risk, and we don't know the numbers, of having your autoimmune disease flare and being really, really bad. So in that kind of setting, that's really a very individualized discussion. I think that'll have to be discussed.
Any specific autoimmune disease? I remember we were talking one time about multiple sclerosis, and you seemed like real concerned about that.
You know, it's funny. That's the one that I worry about. It's basically a T-cell mediated disease. It's CNS. So if this flares, you know, it actually can be fatal in some patients. But when I said this to some of my colleagues, they told me that they had actually treated patients with under control multiple sclerosis. So I don't really know.
I know. I've heard that. But it scares you.
Absolutely.
What about it is it specifically?
The fact that it's T-cell mediated. So the way that these drugs work is they activate T-cells. So multiple sclerosis is very clearly T-cell mediated.
So let's move on and talk a little bit about cancer of the bladder and where checkpoint inhibitors are fitting in. First of all, again, taking a step back at the basic biology of disease, any comments?
Yeah, bladder is actually a very good candidate. I mean, bladder, you know, the very first immunotherapy we used in cancer was not checkpoint blockade. It was not Sipuleucel-T. It was BCG for bladder cancer, right? This is probably the first FDA-approved immunotherapy. And it's funny, Neil, if you go to a bladder meeting and you talk to the surgeon, the urologist, and you say immunotherapy, that means to them BCG, right?
Right.
So we knew from the BCG experience that bladder cancer could be treated, particularly superficial, and sometimes even cured with the immune system using BCG, actually.
Could I ask you what your vision is about exactly how BCG works?
It's a great question. I recently wrote a chapter for Campbell's textbook of urology. Spent a lot of time looking into the literature and how this works.
Wow, that's an old book. I remember that from med school.
Oh, there's a new version.
Campbell Urology.
This is hopefully a newer version, actually. So what it looks like is that BCG binds to the bladder wall, and there what it does is activate cells from the innate, not the adaptive, the innate immune system. This means that it activates neutrophils and then also macrophages. So that's probably how it starts a response. There's very good data for neutrophil migration, activation. That's how it starts. We know, though, that there are long-term responses, and long-term responses from the immune system are almost never innate. What they are is adaptive. So there are good data, particularly in animal models, less so in patients, that eventually you wind up getting a nice T-cell response to some degree. That's really reflected a little bit in cytokine data in patients and some other ways, but I think that early on it's an innate activity, activating neutrophils, macrophages, and later progressing to perhaps a T-cell mediated effect.
I've heard, I think it was Len Gamella actually I interviewed for this same program, talking about maybe using checkpoint inhibitors at that point, early stage disease.
It's not a terrible idea, actually. I mean, whenever you turn on an immune response, the immune system fights back to keep it in check by upregulating checkpoints and checkpoint ligands. So you can definitely augment the magnitude of an early immune response by blocking a checkpoint. So I think it's a reasonable idea. The one question you have to ask yourself, though, is BCG is a fairly crude preparation. It activates multiple toll-like receptors, multiple ways to activate the immune system. So would you want to try to think of something a little bit more specific in that setting or not, actually?
So what are the data that we have right now in terms of using these agents with bladder cancer?
We have beautiful data, frankly. I mean, the data that were presented, atezolizumab, phase two, fairly large phase two trial, are fairly comprehensive. They're one of the best data sets we have for checkpoint blockade at this stage of development in any cancer we've ever had. So in this trial, second line patients were treated with atezolizumab, standard dose and schedule. About 300 patients were reported on at GU ASCO by Dr. Jean Hoffman-Sentis. And she did a great job. Basically, the overall response rate was similar to what was seen before, 25% range, something like that. And there was evidence of a PD-L1 effect, actually. The patients with a higher level of PD-L1 tended to have a more chance of responding. Neil, the data there that were really different, though, actually, that presented, was at the bottom of her table, right? She had the number of complete responders across there. And I got to tell you, this was, for me, really exciting, because what you could see is, first of all, with any PD-L1 level, there were some complete responders. But when you looked across the whole group of patients, there were maybe like 5%, maybe even a little higher, complete responders. This is really quite good. I mean, these are the patients that tend to do well. You know, in contrast, although we've been developing PD-1 and kidney cancer for a while, in the phase 3 trial that was recently published in New England Journal of Medicine, there weren't any complete responders, honestly. So I think that bladder is very exciting, both by the response rate in this refractory setting and also by the number of complete responders.
What fraction of responding patients have prolonged responses with bladder, with renal, and in general?
Neil, great question. It's still a little too early to tell. So the cut of data that they showed at GU ASCO was fairly early in this IMvigor trial. So we don't know how many patients will have this continue for a year, 2 years, 3 years. What I can share with you is from my clinical experience is when a patient has a durable response off treatment, it tends to be durable for quite some time.
So where right now do you think this should fit in? And how do you feel about the fact that, you know, with these kinds of data, the drug's not available?
Drug should be available soon, I hope. It was a single-arm trial. Because it was a single-arm trial, Neil, it enrolled very, very quickly, right? And the data that they presented at GU ASCO are certainly probably quite a bit better than chemotherapy, which would be the standard treatment in this setting. So I'm really very hopeful that approval will be announced before the end of the year. But, you know, honestly, these drugs, they all look fairly similar. So anti-PD-1, nivolumab, pembrolizumab, atezolizumab, they look pretty similar. So I can tell you that physicians are trying to use off-label pembrolizumab or nivolumab in bladder cancer patients until atezolizumab winds up being marketed.
There are pembrolizumab data, I think, in bladder, right?
Oh, absolutely. Betsy Plumack has reported on some cases with pembro. And as you indicated, it looks quite similar to what atezolizumab looks like.
Is there any differentiating point right now between these agents? Early on, I was hearing the question of do anti-PD-L1 antibodies have less toxicity, less pulmonary toxicity? It kind of seems like they all have similar efficacy.
I think that the data right now with really no head-to-head or even similar trials to compare make it a little bit challenging. I think that what you said is actually fairly correct, that they have similar activity, a similar spectrum of activity, fairly similar toxicity as well.
I like being fairly correct. Anyhow, so right now, if you had these agents available, and as you say, in a sense, we sort of do, where do you think the ideal place is? Again, it starts out second line, but yet you're looking at first line, you know, platinum. Not everybody is very enthusiastic about giving or receiving platinum, or a lot of people can't get it. Where do you think it ought to be placed?
This is true. I think that in bladder cancer, the argument for moving to first line is quite strong, right? I mean, the regimens that we use, MVAC, GEMSYS, these kinds of intensive regimens are challenging for many, many patients. And, you know, in the first line, these regimens do have a pretty good response rate, sometimes as high as up 30%. Never durable, but sometimes very good responses. So that gives you a fairly nice window. So what you can do with these patients is if you treat with anti-PD-L1, say, for example, for a couple of months, it really takes really about 2 or 3 months to know for sure, say, and they don't respond, guess what? There's plenty of MVAC in the back closet that you could try. There's plenty of GEMSYS. So I think trying the fairly efficacious, less toxic regimen first, particularly in bladder, is one that might make a little bit more sense.